We were talking about Matthew somewhere, weren't we? Yeah. This could have come about, but it isn't going to, we know. And we're starting to see the change in this going away and something else taking place instead of it. Let me stick this on here. We can think about this for a little bit. This is what we know actually ends up taking place. Okay. There is a break in that pattern. There's a discontinuity in there. There's something new and different that wasn't known about before. It's called, well, it just refers to it as the kingdom of heaven and describes it for us in Matthew chapter 13. Most of it we know is the church age, the age in which we're living. Not all of it, but most of it. Because it had never been mentioned before to anybody. The Old Testament saints and scholars, they didn't know anything about the church, the ecclesia. It was not mentioned at all until we got all the way into Matthew chapter 16 last week. And in Matthew chapter 16, the Lord mentions it for the first time in verses 16 and 17. And he bases, well, let's just read what he says and I'll try to explain to you. He asked the disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And Peter said, "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." Peter is correct. His spiritual understanding is right on the money. The person of Christ is the Son of God. And he makes that profession of faith in the person of Christ. And then Jesus says to him, said, "Peter, you blessed are you because flesh and blood didn't reveal that to you. You didn't come to the realization that I am the Son of God based upon your natural state. But my Father who is in heaven revealed that to you. And I say to you that, Peter, your name means rock, and I'm going to do something else. I'm going to build on a certain rock." He's going to use a play of words here based on Peter's name. And what he's going to build on is this profession of faith that Peter made there in verse 16. "Thou art the Son of the living God." So the thing that he's going to build, we translate it church in verse 18. It's the word ecclesia. He says, "I'm going to build that. And I'm going to build it based upon a profession of faith in me. Everyone who makes a profession of faith in me as the Son of God will be a building block in that ecclesia, in that group, that called out one, that church. And furthermore, the gates of Hades will not prevail over it," which implies they will try. It implies there will be an opposition to the building of the ecclesia. But he's going to give these guys, the apostles, some authority in that process. And he uses the metaphor of keys. Now, the key was a symbol of authority. It was worn by the chief steward in a household, and it was the key to the warehouse of goods that the household owned. The food and other things were stored in this household, and the chief steward wore that key around his neck. It was always on his person. He managed the household goods. When it was time to get food out of there, he got it out of there. When it was managed to get anything else, any other resources, he got it out of there. He had authority over that household and that storehouse. And so the Lord uses that metaphor and says he's going to give that same kind of authority to the apostles. "And whatever they shall bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatsoever they loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." So he introduces the concept of binding and loosening. Now, where this concept comes from and why they would know about it is that the Jewish rabbis always had a little team of interpreters in place at all of the Jewish feasts. That's who the Lord was talking to when he was 12 years old. Remember when they left him behind and had to go back to find him. They found him in the temple talking to these guys. This little team of interpreters of the law played this role. If a Jewish patron wanted to participate in the feast and offer sacrifices and all that kind of stuff, and he wasn't sure that he was eligible, that he did not have some sin preventing him from doing that, he would go to this little team of guys, this little judge ship and ask them, does this, what I've done, my circumstances, does that bind me against the law? Is the law against me in this particular case? Am I bound by what I have done? Am I in violation of the law? Or am I loosed from it because what I did doesn't really violate the law, and therefore I can go ahead and offer my sacrifices and participate in the feast and all that kind of stuff? So there's this little team of looseners and binders present at the feast that would hear cases and make judgments as to whether or not the law applied to them and prevented them from participating, or whether or not they were loosed from it and could go ahead and participate if they wanted to. Remember, the Lord criticized the Pharisees later on and said, you guys put these heavy burdens on people. You bind heavy loads on them and you don't do a thing. You don't lift a finger to loosen anything on them because they like to do that. So the concept is that of making judicial pronouncements that were either restrictive or non-restrictive. Okay, got the idea in general? Now, to illustrate the kind of pronouncement that they could make that would be in harmony with what heaven has already made, we use the point that you can say to one of your friends that you're witnessing to that if they have accepted Jesus Christ as their Savior, they are saved. They're born again. They have passed from potential judgment into a state of inheriting glory. And none of that is because you said it. It's because God has said it. You're saying what He has said. You have the authority to speak for Him based upon what He has already said. At the same time, you could tell somebody if they refuse to accept God's only provision for their salvation, they're lost. They're one heartbeat away from an eternity in conscious torment. It isn't because you said it that made it. He said it. He established the truth. You just simply spoke it. But you have the authority to speak that for Him because He has already established that truth. That would be binding the law of God against that person. If a person was saved, you in essence would be loosening him from the judgment that would to come. So you get the picture of binding and loosening. Well, the apostles were given that authority in the early church. They could make pronouncements like that based upon what is already been established in heaven. And oddly enough, the Catholic Bible translates that better than our English Bibles or our Protestant Bibles, because it says whatever you bind on earth will have already been bound in heaven. And whatever you loose on earth is what has already been loosed in heaven. The Douay Bible, in the translation of that verse in the margin, makes that clearer than our Protestant Bibles do. So that's what's being talked about there. So the yes, Janet.
Comment? Well, the translation might make it better, but you know, this is where they get the whole idea of confession.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of misapplication of some of these things, unfortunately, that does indeed follow. But yeah, the translation there would actually be helpful if they would maybe just adhere to that more closely. So apostles have some authority in the building of the church, the ecclesia, the called out ones. Now, nobody's ever heard about that before. Did that go off on its own or did I turn it off? I guess I turned it off. All right. So this thing right here, this parentheses, this wedge in this old program is now going to be the center of focus going forward. They don't know squat about this thing. They'd never heard of it before. So it's going to be a case of building up some principles and truths and tools in a toolbox, so to speak, that he later explains and they begin to learn and understand and function in it. Most of it will be the church age, but not all of it. And it's just now appeared in our study. We just now have reason to believe that the old system isn't going to come about. But we just now had that. We hadn't had it before. We've been suspicious that the trend is not good. We've been noticing that the leadership is not believing him and the trend toward the institution of the Messianic Kingdom, that ain't looking good. But we haven't seen any actual statement to that effect until we get to this. So it's just now starting to appear on the scene, so to speak. Then he goes on and says, from that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and raised up on the third day. Is that part of the Messianic Kingdom program? No, that ain't got anything to do with the Messianic Kingdom. Clearly, it ain't going to happen now. He's told these guys, I've got to go up to Jerusalem and suffer death at the hands of men. And they're thinking, what? That's not part of the Messianic Kingdom. The Messianic Kingdom, he comes in his glory, establishes his kingdom here on earth, and we guys that have followed him for 3.5 years will be part of that. So they're confused, to say the least. Yeah, Jane.
Did you skip that verse that said that he charged his disciples not to tell anyone that he was Jesus? 20, verse 20. Does your Bible have that?
No, I think, I think he's once again there simply not giving more signs to a nation that's already under judgment for rejecting those signs. So the more he now tells them that he is the Messiah and they reject him, the more under judgment they're going to be. Woe to you, Chorazin. Woe to you, Bethsaida. Sodom and Gomorrah is going to be better off than you. So I think that's why he's restricting this witness or testimony here. Now, this presents for the apostles or the disciples here a real dilemma. They were looking forward to the Messianic Kingdom and the glory associated with that kingdom coming about and them being part of that. So when Peter hears Jesus talk about going up to Jerusalem and dying, he can't stand that. He grabs him and says, you ain't going to do that. God forbid it, Lord. This shall never happen to you. And that philosophy, unfortunately, is a satanic philosophy. And so the Lord responds to him, in essence, as though he is Satan's spokesman in that case, and says, get behind me, Satan. And says, that thinking is anthropocentric, man-centered. That's what man wants. But God's program and plan is theocentric. And that's what God is going to bring about. So they know now that it isn't going to happen. They know that that plan, with that gap in it, that new form of the kingdom that they don't know anything about yet, that's actually what's going to come about, not the one that they're hoping for. So all of a sudden now their expectation for the glorious Messianic Kingdom just went down the drain. What's going to happen to the glory of the Messiah? If he's not going to institute the Messianic Kingdom and reveal himself in all his glory in that kingdom, has that been lost? Will that be erased because of his death? And so he says to them, verse 28, truly I say to you, there are some of those who are standing here who shall not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. Some of those guys standing there talking to him are going to see the Messianic Kingdom. Now, how's that going to work? Are they going to live another 2,000-3,000 years and be around when he comes back a second time? Probably not. So he's going to do a miraculous thing. He's going to do something that really is spectacular. 6 days later, some prophecies are fulfilled very, very long after they're made. Some are fulfilled pretty darn quick, huh? This one was fulfilled 6 days after it was made. This is instant prophecy here, not the slow-baked kind that you got to cook forever. 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, his brother, and brought them up to a high mountain by themselves. Three guys, Peter, James, and John, and brought them up to a high mountain by themselves, and he was transfigured before them. And his face shone like the sun, and his garments became as white as light. How does he do that? How does he unveil his veiled glory, I wonder? I don't know. there's this whole spiritual creation out there that we don't see into, where the angels live and where God lives and all that stuff goes on. And we can't see into that thing until he does something like this and peels back whatever that veil is and shows it to us, or to these guys here anyway. And in that peeling back of that veil, whatever it is, these guys get to see into the heavenly realm. They see what Christ's glory in heaven actually is. I don't know how he does that. But when he does it, they see him as he will be in the Messianic kingdom. His face is shining like the sun. His garments became white as light. And there's some guys there. Moses and Elijah appeared to them, talking with the Lord. How do they know it's Moses and Elijah? They wearing name tags? I don't know. And how is it that they can see them? How can these physical guys see these other guys? Are they occupying some sort of an interim body? Not the resurrected body, we don't think. That doesn't come until later for Old Testament saints. Comes for us at the rapture. Comes from them, I think, at the second advent. It ain't that, but it looks like it's something. They appear to be in human form, occupying a body of some kind, and it's two guys that they can recognize. And they're speaking. What language are they speaking? I don't know. The Lord understands it. They're speaking with him. Maybe it's Hebrew. Maybe it's Aramaic. Maybe it's Greek. Probably not English. Darn it. We're probably going to have to learn something. I don't know. Some odd things going on here, aren't they? Why these two guys, Moses and Elijah? Of all the people that are there, why these two guys? Most of the commentators you'll find will say that they represent people that will get there by the two means that you can get there. One is death, that's Moses, through resurrection. And the other is translation, and that's Elijah, representing the translated believers. That's probably as good a guess as any. I don't know anything better than that.
Prophet and priest.
You got the prophet and you got the giver of the law. So all the law and the prophets, you got the entire Old Testament era represented by these two guys. I mean, who's better? Who else would be better to represent the entirety of the Old Testament revelation concerning Messiah and his kingdom than those two guys? They're probably as good as anybody. I don't know anybody be any better. But I don't know exactly, you know, why they're there, but clearly they're as good a representative as anybody. And they're talking with him. What do you think they're talking about? He's just told these guys that he's got to go up to Jerusalem and to die. God's plan of redemption is starting to come into focus now. We haven't seen that before. Maybe it's got something to do with that. Maybe they are some sort of encouragement to the Lord. I don't know. But at any rate, what Peter, James, and John are seeing now is a little mini picture, a little slice of the Messianic kingdom. And there's the Lord there, and his servants are there, and guys that represent the entirety of the Old Testament era focusing on that are there. So Peter, seeing all of that, he says in verse 4, Lord, it's good for us to be here. Amen to that, bro. If you wish, I'll make three tabernacles here, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. Well, what kind of a silly statement is that? He wants to make some tabernacles, booths, these little temporary booths that are associated with the Feast of Tabernacles. Okay? That sounds just totally nuts, doesn't it? What's the matter with that guy? Well, not as much as we might think, because the Feast of Tabernacles is actually an observance of the Messianic kingdom to come. So when Peter sees it, he's thinking, hey, This is why we celebrate this Feast of Tabernacles every year. Now that we're here in the Messianic Kingdom, let's celebrate it again. Let's memorialize this thing and build these little booths, one for the Lord and one for Elijah and one for Moses. His theology is right on. His practicality ain't too great. Where's he going to get some branches and twigs and stuff to build these little booths out of, I wonder? I don't know about that. Maybe he had something in mind. I don't know. But he's actually making a proper response to the Messianic Kingdom that he is seeing. He's tasting it. He's got a little sample of it. He's seeing it and says, all right, let's observe this with the same thing we're doing down there on earth in building these booths during that feast. Remember, that's one of the three pilgrimage feasts. Remember them? Passover, Pentecost 50 days later, and Tabernacles in the fall. So those three were the ones that the adult males had to go up to Jerusalem to celebrate every year. So Peter's right on here. I don't know about his practicality, what he would do, but he sees the association of the Feast of Tabernacles and the Messianic Kingdom, and that is correct. Leviticus 23, by the way, if you want to see all those feasts and the storyline behind them. So they're kind of talking and observing this thing and seeing the glory that the Lord will display during the Messianic Kingdom. And while he was still speaking, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and behold, a voice out of the cloud saying, this is my beloved Son with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him. Well, who's that, I wonder? Well, who do you think it is? If Jesus is his beloved Son, who is it? It's God the Father, of course. And the word he uses for beloved there, you will be interested in. It's the word for an only child. It's the same word that's used of you. How can that be? How can the Lord manage the focusing of his mental capacities on each one of us as an individual child when there's billions of us? He's good. He's very, very good. And that's how he thinks and treats us all. We're like his only one. Same description of his son he uses of all of us. That as we are brought into the ecclesia, we're his only child. So his awareness of our needs, of our desires and goals and service and all of that is like that of an only child. Well, that scares the daylights out of them. When they heard this, they fell on their faces and were much afraid. I don't suppose you could stand in God's presence in a corrupt body like we have and not be afraid, would you? He's probably so awesome and so mighty that standing in his presence in these vessels, you'd probably be afraid. That's probably a reasonable response on their part. And Jesus, and they fell on their faces. Jesus came to them, touched them, and said, arise, do not be afraid. And lifting up their eyes, they saw no one except Jesus himself alone. How does he do that, I wonder? How does he pull that veil back and then roll it back in place? There's a lot that we're going to experience that we don't know a whole lot about right now, isn't there? As when he comes back for us. And so he puts things back like they were. They're back to their normal selves and their normal bodies, not being able to see into the spiritual creation, and everything is back to normal. So that prophecy was fulfilled in 6 days. They saw the glory of our Lord, the Messianic Kingdom, right there with those other two participants, responded to it with the suggestion of making booths, and that's got to be one of the coolest experiences anybody's ever had. Why does he do it, I wonder? Why have this revelation at all? Well, remember the storyline now that he's just told him. Things are going to change. What they had hoped to experience, what they thought might come about, isn't going to. The worst possible news they could get is that he's going to die and leave them. You think you could use a little little shot of encouragement, maybe? A real stiff cup of coffee, maybe? Yeah, I think this experience is probably designed to encourage these guys at a time when they really needed it. What they think is slipping through their hands, the Messianic kingdom, and the glory of Christ that would be revealed in it, what they think is getting away from ain't getting away at all. It's going to happen. They just don't know when. Unlike us, we know when. They don't know that. So I think the whole experience is probably for the benefit of encouraging and motivating the disciples in lieu of this new change in eschatology that's coming about here. Certainly it would be, I would think, a boost for those guys. Now, as they were coming down from the mountain, Jesus commanded them, saying, "Tell the vision to no one until the Son of Man has risen from the dead." Same thing there, Jane, that you were asking about. Looks like he's probably saying, no more signs given to the nation now because of this change, because if you reject those signs, the judgment on you will be even greater. And so he just kind of mutes the revelation of this until after he has been raised from the dead. And his disciples asked him this question, was having seen Elijah there, they said, "Well, why do the scribes say," the scribes would be the interpreters of the law, the teachers of the law, "why do they say that Elijah must come first? If Elijah's already there in heaven, how is he going to come first before the kingdom is actually instituted?" And he answered and said, "Well, Elijah is coming and will restore all things." That is, there will be a forerunner to the Messianic kingdom in the mode of Elijah here. "But I say to you," he says, "that Elijah already came." The guy who fulfilled that role was who? John the Baptist. Yeah, he came forerunning the Lord's ministry. But they did not recognize him, and they did to him whatever they wished. So also the Son of Man is going to suffer at their hands. The same thing is going to happen to the Messiah as his forerunner, as happened to him, which was he was killed. Men killed John the Baptist, the forerunner of the Messianic kingdom, and they're going to do the same thing to the Messiah as he's already told them. So also the Son of Man is going to suffer at their hands. And when the disciples understood, they had spoken to them about John the Baptist. So quite an experience for these guys, a learning lesson to be sure, one that probably they didn't totally grasp, but will become clearer to them as time goes on, I think. Now, the next lesson they learn has to do with the modus operandi in this new kingdom, in this new era. It won't be based upon ritualistic keepings of certain legal events, the law, and transpirances. It'll be based on something else. So when they came to the multitude, a man came up to them, falling on his knees before him, saying, I'm in 15 now, "Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is a lunatic and very ill. He often falls into the fire and often into the water. I brought him to your disciples, and they could not cure him." We've talked a little bit before about how prevalent demon activity was at the first advent. It will also be very prevalent at the second advent. Remember now, this war that takes place in heaven, Revelation 12, and between the angels and the bad angels all get thrown out, and they're confined to the earth. All of that evil comes down here. Whatever's going on in the heavenly realm that we don't see into now will be going on down here on this planet from the middle of the tribulation period on for the last 3.5 years. How many millions of those evil angels will be down here doing things? So I suspect at the second advent, it will be just as bad as the first. But here's a case where this youngster is demon-possessed, and the father brought him to the disciples, and they could not cast the demon out. Now, what happened? Why couldn't they? The Lord responds with, it looks like, a tad of frustration. In verse 17, first he says, "O unbelieving and perverted generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring him here to me." They don't seem to ever have an interest in their spiritual needs. It's just these physical blessings that he bestows upon the race that seems to motivate them. And Jesus rebuked him, and the demon came out of him, and the boy was cured at once. Jesus rebuked this demon, and he came out of this boy. This is the same word that's used of the storm that was going on before, after feeding the 5,000, when he rebuked the weather, and the weather stopped and settled down. Why would you speak to weather using the same terms that you used to speak to a demon? Unless, perhaps, there's some demonic involvement in the weather. You guys agree? Think there's some demonic involvement in the weather? Yeah. I think so. I'm very suspicious, at least, of that. At any rate, he cures this youngster. Then disciples came to him privately and said, well, why could we not cast it out? And he said, well, because of the littleness of your faith. The operating principle of this new era that they're just starting to learn about is not legalistic observances. It is faith. This is a faith-based entity. The modus operandi of this entire form of the kingdom is faith. And they had so little that the adversary to that kingdom triumphed over them in this particular instance. They were not able to cast him out. I truly say to you, if you have faith as a mustard seed, that would be just a little bit, you shall say to this mountain, and by the way, mountains are typically metaphors for kingdoms, spiritual kingdoms, Satan's realm, or some other. It can be used of physical kingdoms as well, but is often used of Satan's realm. So if you have just a little bit of faith, you shall say to this mountain, to Satan's kingdom, move from here to there, and it shall move, and nothing shall be impossible to you. That is, faith will be the prime mover in this era. That's what will get things done, or won't get things done, depending on whether one has it or not. Do you have a verse 21 with some big brackets by it? Yeah, remember what that means? It means don't go crazy over that verse. It probably wasn't there in the original translation. It's not in the best manuscripts. So, but this kind does not go out except by prayer and fasting may not have been there. It may have been added, and it may be true. You just don't know. But the translators are giving you a heads up that that particular verse was not in the best manuscripts that they have. So look at it, think about it, but don't build your entire theological base on verses that have big brackets around them, okay? Maybe that's true, maybe it's not. What is true is that the modus operandi of this new era that they need to know about is faith. And at times, a lack thereof will allow the enemy to be victorious. So that was the case with this guy. So he tells him again about his upcoming betrayal and death. While they were gathering together in Galilee, Jesus said to them, the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and he will be raised on the third day. Now, they seem to grasp what he's saying on the first two of the 3 points. The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. But they don't seem to grasp that point about him being raised on the third day. They don't ask about it. They don't.
They'd heard the first part before.
They've heard all of this before. Yeah, that's right. Or that he was going to be killed by men,
yeah,
and raised up the third day. So really, they've heard all of it. But they don't seem to grasp on that third point very well. What really gets them discouraged and depressed is they understand the first two. They see, again, the whole of their commitment to the Lord for the past 3.5 years going down the drain with his upcoming death. They don't understand God's plan of redemption that's actually being laid in this interval. This picture is far, far more important to the race of mankind than the other picture. This picture has a plan of redemption in it right here. We're going to have a Savior come out of these events. If that other one had come about, I don't know what we'd had. They don't understand that yet, though. They just see their commitment sort of dissolving away right in front of them when he keeps talking about being killed, and they seem to miss that being raised on the third day stuff. But they've been told, and they've been told. And it takes them a while. I mean, he has to appear to them. He has to tell Thomas, for example, look, stick your hand right here, Thomas, and see all these scars in my wrist and hand area here where I was nailed to the cross. See that it's me. Some of the others maybe believed a little better, a little quicker, but, I mean, he had to actually appear to them. Then he stayed around for 40 more days to teach them and explain to them these things that he's kind of giving them as tidbits here as we go along, these lessons that he's teaching them now. He explained, I think, during that 40 days. Next lesson has to do with our rights, their rights perhaps in particular, in this era, in this new interval. And he uses the tax that supports the temple to illustrate this point to them. When they come to Capernaum, those who collected the 2 drachma tax came to Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the 2 drachma tax?" What this is a little tax to support the temple. So that's how they, you know, maintained it and kept it up and all that kind of stuff. They just charged this little 2 drachma tax of everybody. So all the Jews that were God-fearing guys would pay this little tax. It wasn't a lot, but it was used to support the house of God. And so the guys who collect that, the tax collectors, the IRS agents, came to Peter and said, "Hey, don't you guys pay this tax?" And Peter said, "Oh, yeah, we pay it." He didn't know whether they did or not. So when he came into the house, Jesus spoke to him first. He didn't even wait for Peter to bring it up. Jesus brings it up. And he says, "What do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth collect customs or poll tax, from their sons or from strangers?" Who supports the government of a certain kingdom, the citizenry or the children of the king? The children of the king get a pass. The kingdom is supported by its citizenry. The house of God is supported by people, not the Son of God. He doesn't have to support his own house. And upon this, when he asked Peter the question, he said, "Well, from strangers." And he says, "Well, consequently, the sons are exempt." That is, Jesus and his immediate followers here didn't have to pay this tax. So why even bring it up? And here's the principle in the next verse. "But lest we give them offense." There's the principle. Even though they did not have to pay the tax, even though they had privilege and prerogatives, in order to not offend someone else, Jesus is going to forego that right, that exemption, and go ahead and pay that tax. So the principle is that even though you have certain liberties within this new-founded kingdom, there are times that if you exercise that liberty, it gives offense to other people. You should not exercise it. Forgo your right if it causes offense. Paul talks about this quite a bit in the New Testament. We call it gray areas, things where we have Christian liberties that we can do whatever we want to do. Usually use the example of drinking a cold beer. If you got somebody that doesn't drink, you might not want to guzzle one right in front of them. Just forego that privilege, okay? You can do that, but it's better to not do it if you give offense, that type of thing. That's what he's talking about here. But look how he goes about raising the money. Look at the fundraiser here. He tells Peter to take his fishing pole, not his net. He's a net fisherman. He ain't a pole fisherman. But take his pole and go down to the river or the lake there and chuck that baby out there. And the first fish that he catches, look in its mouth, and it's going to have a coin that is exactly that 2 drachma coin. Now, why doesn't Jesus just reach in his pocket and pull out a little pocket change and say, "Here, go pay this, Peter"? Well, remember what he's just told them about in that healing of that demon-possessed boy, that the operating principle in this new kingdom is faith. So when Peter hears this harebrained idea about going down and trying to catch a fish, and the fish is going to have some money in its mouth, he could very easily have said, "Are you kidding me? I've never heard of anything so ridiculous." So Peter's being taught the principle of faith. Believe what the Lord has said and go do what the Lord had said. I'm sure he's mumbling to himself the whole way. He's saying, "This is ridiculous. Even if I can catch a fish, it ain't going to have any money in its mouth." But it did. And his learning the lesson of obeying the Word of God, trusting Him, having faith in what He says to do, is paramount in this new kingdom. Now, we've seen Peter behave on a number of occasions rather, what shall we say, rashly, ridiculously, like he was an idiot. But when we see him a little later on, and ain't very much later, in the book of Acts, Peter is a real pillar in this ecclesia. He's strong. He's faithful. He's learning his lessons clearly. And it was Peter who let the dogs in Acts chapter 10, and not Paul. Gentiles come into the ecclesia by Peter's involvement and activity in Acts chapter 10. Paul's saved already. He's saved in chapter 9. Chapter 10 comes after chapter 9. But he still uses Peter. Peter is a real hoss in the early days of the church. So he's struggling along, kind of trying to get his feet under him and all that stuff at this point in time. But later on, he is quite a leader. And lessons like this probably come back to him, and he probably remembers, "You know, as ridiculous as I thought that was, I obeyed what God said, and everything worked out. There was a coin in that fish's mouth. And after you take the coin out, you can eat the fish." So it worked out well for everybody, didn't it? And the Lord uses the whole teaching experience now to teach the principle of don't give offense when you have the means not to. And even at times it might be a very faithful experience on your part to do that. So, another lesson for Peter to tuck away and to mull over later. Next lesson is one obviously these guys need, because it has to do with humility and the lack thereof. At that time, the disciples of Jesus came, saying, "Who's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" That's really what you want to hear your followers to be hung up on, isn't it? Which one of us gets to be the greatest in this new era, this new kingdom of heaven thingy that you're talking about, this ecclesia? Is that the perspective you think he wants them to have, to be worried about who's going to be the greatest in it? Now, their attitudes need a little adjusting, and so he adjusts it. He called a child to himself and set him before them. The illustration here is going to involve that of a child. Whatever the characteristics of a child be, they are going to relate to this question they ask. Who's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? He says, "Truly I say, unless you are converted and become like little children, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven." Whoa, what's he talking about then? What are the characteristics of a child that normally come to mind to you? Are they dependent on their parents? Yeah. If they want a cookie, they can't go get in a car and drive down to the grocery store and write a check and buy a package of cookies, can they? They have no wherewithal. They have no ability. They have nothing. They got to go to mom or dad and say, "Can I have a cookie?" And they're totally dependent upon their parents. So childlikeness is not greatness, it's humility and dependence. Whoever then humbles himself as this child, he is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Humility, dependence upon God, that is greatness in the kingdom of heaven. The elevator up in the kingdom of heaven goes down. You want to become great in this new kingdom that he's talking about? Become a great servant. You think that idea goes down easy in the Greco-Roman world? No, the concept of servitude was, they abhorred that. And those Greeks and Romans, they didn't want to serve, they wanted to be served. This is an idea that is unique to Christianity. And it wouldn't come easy on the part of even the disciples to understand that humility and servitude is what makes us great in the kingdom of heaven. So the idea would be, it would fly in their face pretty hard at first here. So that child and the childlike dependence upon God is very much illustrative of what he wanted them to know. And furthermore, whoever receives one of each of such child in my name receives me. The union between him and his followers is such that however you treat his followers, that's how you treat him. So if you are receptive and kind to his followers, it's like being receptive and kind to him. But and the corollary is true, whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to stumble. Now notice the actual person he's referring to here are believers, those who believe in him. The child is representing believers in this parable, in this story. And if you cause one of them to stumble, a believer to stumble, it's better for him that a heavy millstone be hung around his neck and that he be drowned in the depth of the sea. The way they processed grain, the way they ground grain, is that they had these two big slabs of stone, one on top of the other, and a hole in the one where you could pour the grain down, and they would spin the top one, usually by animal or something attached to it. He'd walk in circles, and the top stone would then grind around, and it'd grind the grain down into flour, into powder. And it was heavy by design, usually bigger than this thing. And if you had one of those tied around your neck and thrown into the sea, you going to swim very far? Mm-mm. And he's saying, if you cause a believer to stumble, it would be better for you to have that big stone around your neck and you'd be chucked into the ocean with it. Obviously, you would be better off dead than to cause one of his believing followers to stumble or to sin or to error because of their association with him. So guys, the answer to your question, who's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven, is who's the greatest servant? Who is the most childlike in terms of his dependence upon God? And that's who is the greatest. If you cause one of them to stumble, to sin, to error, the judgment against you is such that you'd be better off dead than to go through that. And of course, the Pharisees were very much a category of people that would fit that bill. They were leading people astray. They were not entering in the kingdom themselves, and they were blocking those that did want to get in. So he may have them primarily in mind as he's stating this principle. All right, we've got to knock off here this morning. Questions or comments about the things we've seen here so far? The transfiguration shows the disciples that his glory is still to come. It's just going to be later than they think. And some of the other principles of life that they need to know about are being taught to them. Faith is the operating principle in this kingdom. Humility and service will be what marks greatness in it, not the other way around that they normally think of. And there'll be more lessons for them as we go forward. Any questions about any of what we've seen so far? This is the eschatology that we know about. We don't know what would have happened if the other one had come about. Can't figure that out. God came to, the Lord came to be the Savior of mankind, and he also came to institute the Messianic kingdom. I don't know how he resolved all of that, but I know God had a plan, a program, he to come up with something. But this is the one we know about, and this is the one we are experiencing even today. We're living in that era, most of which is the church age, but not quite all of it. Questions, comments?
We're stopping at 7, verse
7. Yeah, we'll stop right here. We'll pick up at verse 7 next time. The 90 and 9 is what we'll talk about next week. You got 100 sheep. You lose one of them. Is 99 enough for you? We'll talk about that next week. Any other questions or comments? Yeah, Janet.
All right, got something to say.
It's okay.
Is another a possible insight into that paying the drachma tax is that the even the son was exempt, he paid the price.
Yeah, that's certainly a parallel. That's true. God made him who knew no sin to become sin for us, so we might become the glory of God in him. Yes. Even though he was exempt, and also he was not real thrilled with the way they were treating his father's house when he went up to a couple of those feasts, was he, when he ran those guys out of there. So good parallels there.